Good morning, everyone. My name is Peter Draper. I'm with the South African Institute of International Affairs. I'd like to officially open this seminar and welcome everybody. I'd like to particularly thank the University of International Business and Economics for hosting us. What promises to be a very interesting conversation, I think, about the future of the WTO. I'll give a little word of background on the project of which this dialogue forms part, particularly for our hosts. The project is funded by the World Bank, a development grant facility, which has since closed down, but that was the initial funding agency. Essentially what the project is a multi-country dialogue focused on developing countries particularly and their views on the future of the WTO and particularly how to restore multilateral trade cooperation. That's the title of the project. There have been a few dialogues in a number of countries. We kicked off in South Korea, hosted by Kiev. Shifun is here, represented here. Then we went to Brazil. Vera was down there. Vera Christensen hosted us there. Then we hosted the next dialogue in Johannesburg, in South Africa. And Mr. Fizik is here somewhere. He hosted the last dialogue, which was in Bangladesh, in Dhaka. And now, of course, this is the final roundtable in the series in, I think, a very fitting venue for the final roundtable, which is in Beijing, obviously China. And in each case, what we've tried to do is to get perspectives from the bottom up, as it were. How does the particular country, but also the regions, we try to broaden the conversation beyond just the country, but the regional interests. How does that country and region see the future of the WTO? And of course, we do try to bring in a broader international perspective, so we've got other people from different institutes, different parts of the world as part of our group as well. I should also mention that the initial impetus for the roundtable came from the Courtauld Bell Institute. Dick Cunningham is here, and I'm sure we'll say a bit more about that. And of course, Dick, I think, wouldn't claim to represent the United States, but of course the US is a key player in the future of the multilateral trade system. So Dick brings very important insights from US trade policy.
After hearing me for a while, you may even question whether I am from the United States.
All right, so that's a little bit of background on the roundtable. We're obviously looking very much forward to the conversation over the next couple of days. I think it's a great agenda. It certainly reflects, I think, the key things that China is interested in terms of the WTO and, of course, broader regional perspectives as well. So we're looking forward to engaging in that conversation very much. So I'd like to hand over now to our hosts to say a few words.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Peter. Your Excellency, Ambassador Sun Jae-yu, and distinguished guest, and gentlemen, good morning. On behalf of the hoster, University of United States Economics, I would like to express our sincere welcome all of you to UIBE, to the China Roundtable. And the topic of this roundtable is of extremely importance for the current, the ongoing of the negotiations for the multilateral trade system, and especially now China, we are also in the process of their further reform our, you know, the international reform, and we are possibly involved in the mega regional, you know, negotiations, and we try our efforts to promote the multilateral trade system. And UIPE is, I think, is the right place for this roundtable. This university was established in 1951. As initially it's called the Institute of Foreign Trade. So this university is open for trade. And currently, we have around 16,000 students. Among them, 3,000 international students come from over 137 countries. So you can see this is an international and open university. And also this university, we're quite strong in the WTO studies, in the FTA studies, and we established a research center for the GATT studies in the 1980s. And then we expand this to the study of the multilateral trade system. That's the China Institute for WTO Studies. And also we are very happy to work together very closely with the China Association, or China Society of the WTO Studies, and Ambassador Sun as the chairman of that society. So we work together to promote both the research and education in these areas. So we are very happy to host this roundtable, and I suppose that's the 2 days dialogues will be bringing the very fruitful insight for how to restoring the this multilateral trade system. So, once again, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy time here. So now it's my great honor to be the moderator for the first session, the keynote speech. We are very, very pleased to invite Mr. Sun Zhenyu, the first China ambassador to WTO, now the chairman of China Society of WTO Studies, to give a keynote speech. Ambassador Sun, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Vice President Zhao. It is my great pleasure to attend this round table. It is encouraging to have so many distinguished experts and scholars to get together to have a brainstorming on restoring multilateral trade cooperation. I remember that the former chairman of the NAMA negotiation, the former Swiss ambassador, Lucius Vassesha, once said, in order to participate in a brainstorming session, you need two conditions. First, you must have brain. Second, you must be able to stand the storm. I think he's very wise. And I hope that some very smart and concrete ideas could come out from this roundtable as a contribution to the post-Bali trade negotiations. I want to touch on 4 points. First, I would like to express my little bit cautious optimism on this multilateral trade negotiation. Second, I would like to set 3 conditions for the success of the post-Bali trade negotiations. Third, I would like to talk a little bit about China's role in this negotiation. And finally, some concrete proposals. First, I see this, and there is a promising future for refocusing on multilateral process, at least this year. Because WTO has been on the sidelines for too long, probably since the failure in July 2008, over the last 7 years, the negotiation of FTAs and RTAs has become the main focus of many governments. The most hot topics in recent years have been the mega FTAs, such as TPP, TTIP, RCEP, FTAAP. Anyway, so many P's. In short, there are too many FTAs and RTAs and not many people talking about multilateral trading negotiation. Not much about WTO. Not much about Doha Round. Maybe this group is an exception. Of course, we should not blame governments and ministers for not showing enough interest in WTO and Doha Round. We could only blame the financial crisis in 2008, the domestic politics in some major trading nations, and the flawed WTO decision-making process, which is not so efficient in handling the negotiations. FTAs and RTAs are much easier to have results and give the ministers the sense of achievements. Last year, a local NGO invited me to address, to give a speech under the agenda, the post-WTO trade negotiations. I had to tell them, wait a minute, WTO is not dead yet. If I talk under this subject, under this title, I will be killed by my friends in WTO. So you have to change the type of the title from post-WTO into post-Doha trade negotiation. Bali ministerial meeting at the end of 2013 has been a great boost of morale of WTO members and the Secretariat. After a whole year's delay to start implementing trade facilitation agreement, the discussion on post-Bali work program is now the priority of WTO agenda. In my view, the year 2015 should be a year of critical importance for WTO. In this year, we shall celebrate the 20th anniversary of the founding of WTO. And by the end of the year, we will have trade ministers meeting in Nairobi. And in preparation for the trade ministerial meeting, there will be mini ministerial in Paris during this OECD annual conference in May. And Turkey is suggesting another mini ministerial, probably during the Istanbul G20 summit in September. These events should be golden opportunities for WTO to catch the attention of the world leaders and general public to refocus on multilateral process. Another important factor is the delicate situation that the U.S. is facing in TPP and TTIP negotiations. The U.S. has long been the leader for multilateral negotiations, but it turned its back on Doha Round after 2008 and gave priority to TPP and TTIP negotiations. After 7 years of tough bargaining, the prospects of concluding the negotiations this year looks to me quite uncertain. Of course, some scholars thought, well, they may achieve it this year. But recently, even the Defense Secretary of the U.S. went to Japan to talk about TPP. That's very unusual. If TPP is going very well, I don't think there's any need for the intervention from the Defense Secretary in the TPP negotiation. Maybe, personally, I think maybe he wants to remind Prime Minister Abe Japan should consider more from the political perspective rather than the economic interest, their own economic interest. But anyway, this is very unusual to me. That shows that maybe TPP is not in very good shape. It seems that without TPA from the U.S. Congress, Japan, Canada, and a number of other countries may not show their cards at a very crucial moment. President Obama has come to the strong resistance, has to overcome the strong resistance from his own party in order to get TPA. And he has to rely on the support from the Republican Party, which is pro-trade, yet which may not like to see his success in getting his political legacy in the election year. So, and the good news I got yesterday from the former chair of the General Council, Mr. Jonathan Thrive. He told me that the TPA they are discussing in Congress is not only for TPP, but also in general terms. Mm-hmm. It will cover post-Bali trade negotiations. I think that's encouraging news. The setback of TPP negotiations may turn out to be a good opportunity for post-Bali negotiations. Theoretically, no matter how people claim that RTAs and FTAs are stepping stones or great complements to the multilateral process, the consequences of fragmentation of international trade rules and the effect of spaghetti bowl will lead to trade and investment diversion and create new barriers to trade and investment for non-members of FTAs and RTAs, which would undermine the result of trade facilitation agreement. On top of that, the ongoing plurilateral negotiations of ITA, TISA, and ETA mainly focus on market access concerns of US and some other developed countries. And their success will only lead to further polarization of the world's population and make rich countries richer and poor countries poorer. The lessons of the social crime and terrorism show that the poverty leads to disruption of world peace, stability, and prosperity. Therefore, our leaders should always bear in mind their responsibility to make sure that the outcome of international trade negotiations should deliver the pro-development agenda and prevent further polarization of the world's population. While most of the current negotiations focusing on addressing concerns of developed countries, only Doha Round mandate give priority to addressing concerns of developing countries, such as enormous agricultural subsidies of trade distortion by developed countries, nano-tariff peaks and tariff escalation, and free movement of natural person in service. So this is roughly my assessment of the current situation we are facing. Secondly, I want to touch on the necessary conditions for a successful post-Bali trade negotiations. As far as I can see, there are at least three necessary conditions. A, the political will from the highest authorities of all WTO members. B, the strong engagement by ministers, senior officials, ambassadors, as well as technical experts. There should be more resources to put into multilateral negotiations. C, the great interest and active involvement by think tanks and business communities. The common understanding by all G20 leaders are of great importance. We do hope that the G20 summit in Istanbul this year will provide the political guidance for the post-Bali trade negotiations. Likewise, the APEC leaders meeting, BRICS summit, Euro-Asian summit, etc., are important fora for the leaders to give instructions to push forward the negotiations. The political will by President Obama is, needless to say, crucial. Since TPP negotiations may not go too smoothly, I hope he might as well consider completing Doha Round as a possible political legacy for him, especially if this deal could help conclude the ongoing plurilateral negotiations on ITA, on TISA, on ETA. The strong engagement by ministers is important. We are fortunate to have quite a number of veteran ministers, like Tim Grosser, the New Zealand trade minister, and Amina Mohammed, the foreign minister of Kenya, and also Rob Davis, the South African trade minister, and of course the USTR, Michael Froman. I think Michael Froman is much more professional and experienced than his predecessor. Personally, I think this, his predecessor, Ron Kirk, is the wrong choice, and who is really a politician, a pure politician, and he did not pay not enough attention on the details of the negotiations. And so if the ministers could use their influence to divert more resources from the FTAs and RTAs to multilateral process, we will have better chance for a successful multilateral process. And we are also lucky, the current Director General, Roberto Azevedo, is also quite capable and in certain extent even better than his predecessor. And he really focused his efforts in negotiations in Geneva. And he's working very hard among ambassadors, and also the process of green room meetings are more open and transparent. Now it turned out to be room W meetings, room W process. And the committee chairs are also busy convening meetings at several different levels. The active involvement by the think tanks and the business community is more than necessary. Without their contribution of ideas and strong lobby activities, the chances of success will be very little. I still remember the days in the 1990s when the US Congress were debating MFN for China, most favored nation treatment for China. And we had at that time strong allies from the multilateral companies like GE, like Ford, Motorola, United Technology. They were very active lobbying in the US Congress and in the US government. So we have worked very closely with them. And finally, we saw who are the real boss in the US economy. And in Geneva, when I was in Geneva, I often met representatives from business communities, from the US, from Europe, Japan, and many other countries. So their lobbying force are very, very important. And we hope they could spend some effort, more efforts on multilateral process. Now it seems they are not so strong lobbying activities on multilateral negotiations. And the think tanks also are important. That's why I appreciate this roundtable meetings, which is a collective effort by think tanks in different countries, and put their thoughts together and provide some useful food for thought and proposals to the governments, to respective governments, in order to promote this this multilateral process. So there's a Chinese word. To achieve success, we need 天时地利人和. That means, which is good timing, favorable location, and harmonious efforts of the people. I believe we almost have the three elements on our side, which are the right time, the right place, and the right people to work out the post-Bali work program, or even conclude the deal by before the end of the year. I may sound a little bit too optimistic. My third point is, what role could China play in order to reach a balanced outcome in post-Bali negotiations? I believe that China will play a constructive and positive role in post-Bali negotiations. China spent 15 years to join WTO, and its membership has helped to push forward its domestic reform and opening process, which brought about rapid economic development. China has every reason to strengthen further the multilateral trading system. and participates actively in its rules setting. As the biggest trading nation and the second largest economy, it has a vested interest in keeping the system strong, open, and maintaining the centrality of WTO. The priority of the negotiations is to address the concerns of the developing countries, particularly the LDCs. So the chairman's text on agriculture, is Rev 4, and on NAMA, Rev 3, are the results of very hard work over many years and represent a fairly balanced outcome of the negotiations. We had a tiered formula and the Swiss formula to be more aggressive on higher tariffs than the lower ones. If we intend to lower the ambition in order to conclude the deal, the current balance of rights and obligations should not be disrupted. One of the issues under discussion is the very high expectations placed on the emerging economies like China in the negotiations. The US has made it clear that China and other emerging economies should make more contributions and shoulder more responsibilities. The question is whether China and other emerging economies should have the same treatment as the developed ones. My answer is no. As China's WTO ambassador Yu Jianhua recently said, for the first time in history, the second largest economy in the world also ranks 90th in per capita GDP. In fact, in some parts of our economy, agriculture in particular, many believe we were forced to make too big a concession to enter WTO 10 years ago. No, 15 years ago. Because of lower prices and higher subsidies in the West, we cannot compete with developed countries. So we have limited arable land. Also, we have limited arable land. Our food security supports are for subsistence farmers, not commercial ones, like in some developed countries. Our government will help farmers, but our hands are bound by the WTO. We are a big NAMA exporter, but the developed countries say they can't address their tariff peaks and escalation because of the financial crisis and manufacturing problems. For us, agriculture is totally defensive as we are a net importer. On the other hand, China's role in the negotiation is closely linked to the domestic reform process. The current experiments in Shanghai Pilot Zone, the expanded free trade experiment zones in Guangdong, Fujian, and Tianjin are all good news for the current negotiations. On the one hand, the current experiment will help China to have pressure test and make it possible to adopt certain flexible positions on trade and investment issues, particularly the behind border issues. The negotiations will also bring pressure to further opening and reform process in China. Finally, some initial proposals and thoughts for leaders to consider. First, it is best to keep the chair's text on agriculture and NAMA instead of introducing new approaches of average cut or request and offer as the starting point for negotiations. The main appeal of request and offer can be more likely to achieve a meaningful outcome for the demanders. But the downside is that it is time consuming and resource demanding. It is less transparent, unpredictable, and especially for smaller countries. At the same time, an average cut approach could reduce overall ambition, and the net result could be everyone doing less with greater flexibility, or probably China is the exception, especially among developing countries, since China does not have space between bound and applied tariffs. And the second proposal is that it might not be a bad idea to try a so-called grand bargain. Members might adopt the approach that no negotiation is isolated from others. No matter whether it is post-Bali program or the plurilateral or regional or bilateral negotiations, all the factors should take into account in the multilateral platform. The U.S. turned its back on the Doha round in 2008 because it believed it had given too much on agricultural subsidies without much reward on market access, especially on NAMA sectors and trade in service. But the ITA, EGA, and TISA negotiations could satisfy the U.S. demand on market access in NAMA sectors and in trade in service. But the Doha round is development round. Unless the developing countries' concerns on agricultural subsidies and development issues are addressed, there could not possibly be any balanced outcome. Therefore, the combination of all the current negotiations should provide relatively balanced solution for all members. Third, there are strong arguments from some experts and scholars that to meet the need of the global value chain, it is necessary to deal with this 21st century issues, new issues, such as environment, labor standard, disciplines for SOEs, IPR protection, and other behind border issues. These are issues that are dealt with in TPP and TTIP, with a view to be introduced to WTO for the future WTO rules. Since these issues are not in the mandate of the Doha development agenda, members may consider to put them in the future work program after the conclusion of the Doha round. Of course, this is based on the approach that there will be future rounds of negotiations. If members decide to tackle the issues separately in the future, in order to raise the efficiency of the decision making, we have to adopt a totally new approach. Finally, a piece of suggestions to the Chinese government. My suggestion is that the Chinese government should strengthen coordination at the level of State Council. Now in China, there are so many things. There are so many issues to deal with. There's one road, one belt, there's AIIB, all the important issues to be dealt with. But there should be a very strong coordinating body for multilateral negotiations. In spite of the fact that they already got their hands full on many other fronts, but they should spend more time and more energy on rule setting. And this is the critical year, so we should not miss this chance. China should have a strong coordination among different ministries and departments, and to sum up the experience in this Shanghai pilot zone and Fujian, Guangdong, and Tianjin, so that this combination of domestic reform opening and the negotiation, I think they can promote, they could do the work to promote on both sides. Finally, a piece of advice to the U.S. administration. I think the days are gone when the U.S. set the rules and others to follow. So I hope that the think tanks and the institutions could put more thought in this. And the intention to set rules in TPP and then wait for China to join, as it did to join WTO, I think that will never happen. The best way is to work with China and work with other major emerging economies and to work jointly. I think the recent example about the AIIB shows Probably our two countries have to respect each other's efforts and trying to join efforts and drop this mentalities of a zero-sum game. So only in that by adopting that approach could we eventually have a more steady, more peaceful, more prosperous world. So then, the above is my, we call it Pao Zhuan Yin Yu. I throw in a brick in order to attract jade from the fellow speakers. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ambassador Sun, for a very insightful speech. And now I invite our respondents to make comments. Mr. Dick Cunningham from the Cordell Hull Institute from the United States, and also Mr. Wang Yun from the Peking University.
This is the really horrible time for me at this conference, because I share at least 80, perhaps 90% of your views as to what is important and what needs to be achieved. And I share almost none of your optimism as to how much that can be done in the current effort to devise a post-Bali agenda. And I must say that my own conclusion on the post-Bali agenda is that something as much as could be done should be done, but it will be very minimal, and then we need to find ways to deal with what has become a much greater problem and a much different context of trade negotiations, a context of trade negotiations that has severe difficulties, as you say, for the developing world, for all of those that are left out, not just the developing world. There are agricultural exporters, developed countries, Australia, for example, which has serious problems in the current non-multilateral approach to negotiations. I share entirely, and I want to come back to it in the end, your view that the way through this in the end is to find ways for the major emerging nations, and I will say in particular China, and the major developed countries, and in particular the United States, to find common ground rather than confrontation, and to find ways to work together to do what this set of roundtables, by its title, seeks to achieve, which is to restore multilateral cooperation. Let me give you just a somewhat different viewpoint on the current state of play and my concerns about where it's going and why we're not using the right techniques to get there. I think the Doha Round became something very difficult, different than what certainly the developing world expected it to be when it was announced. The Doha Round by the Cancun ministerial had clearly become no longer a development agenda. It had become a typical horse trading, more mercantilistic exercise of I will give you benefits in my market if you give me benefits in your market. And it didn't work. And it didn't work because there is not in the current World Trade Organization the consensus that existed in the early GATT rounds of everyone viewing trade liberalization as the key to everything. Everyone viewing trade liberalization as something that has benefits for equally for developing and emerging nations. And what I think happened by 2008 is that the developed country, and let me say one other thing about the Doha Round, viewed as a horse trading exercise. One would look at it and say, as Texans say in the United States, this dog won't hunt. This dog, this process doesn't have a prospect for success. The developed countries had fairly little to give on NAMA, for example, because they had very low tariffs. They had substantial demands from the developing countries, and I should not say developing countries, I should say specifically the big emerging countries. And if you think back to the Clinton administration, that was the mantra of the Clinton administration. U.S. trade policy should be devoted to getting more access for our companies, the developed country companies who live in mature, slow-growth economies, more access for those companies to the rapidly growing but more protected economies that are the particularly in the emerging world, the big emerging markets, as the Clinton administration said. In agriculture, the developed countries had substantial demands, as you say. I think entirely legitimate demands, but then again, I've come a generation from the time when my father was a farmer in Iowa, and I don't share some of the views of the American agricultural constituency. But that and the other issues that you mentioned are being left off the table in the current negotiations, issues such as tariff peaks, issues such as mode four services, are issues that are desired by the developing and emerging countries, but are difficult politically for the developed countries to give. And finally, there was a major problem with the Doha Round always, because there were major players in the emerging countries that had very little in the way of offensive interests, very little that they wanted to get. I will tell a story on you, Anwaril, Mr. Hoda from India. Anwaril and I had a dinner in which he said, I will tell you the two things that India wants in the Doha Round. And I said, boy, this is going to unlock the secrets that we're all interested in finding out. He says, well, we want mode four services. I said, yes, everybody knows that. What else does India want? He says, India wants to be let alone. China also had relatively little in the way of offensive interests. I think you, with a good deal of justification, would like to have had significant modifications in the trade remedy regimes of the United States and Europe. But there's not much else that you really wanted to get from the U.S., from Europe, from Canada. And in a situation like that, if you look at it as a give-and-take bargain, there was not much of a give-and-take bargain to be had in the round. And you had to find a way. The way to get anything out of this round in the end, in this exercise Mr. Acevedo is going through now, is to try to find a way to get back to a set of things that we can get that we can all agree on from the standpoint of the type of negotiating dynamic that one would have thought we were going to have when we had a Doha development agenda. That is, that there is a shared consensus on certain types of liberalization that will benefit everybody and that we should all agree on. I suggest to you, however, that that's going to be fairly limited. What has happened, however, that I think is most important is that the game has changed. And led by the United States, the developed countries have said, the Doha Round isn't working. They have said, the U.S. has said something like this, and you will not find this particularly agreeable. They have said, we've tried everything. We tried formulas. Formulas didn't work because formulas wouldn't get us actual trade liberalization. They would reduce the water, that is, the difference between bound tariffs and applied tariffs. But we can't go to the U.S. Congress and say, we are getting actual increases in access to these countries' markets. We've tried sectoral negotiations, and nobody turned out to be interested in that. We're now going to try something as there was a comedy show on British television called Monty Python's Flying Circus, and every show began with the actor John Cleese sitting at a desk and saying, "And now for something completely different." And the United States has moved, with the developed countries generally following, and with some middle countries following, to a non-multilateral approach to trade negotiations. They are following in the words of one of my most unfavorite American presidents, George W. Bush. They have gone to coalitions of the willing. And what they want to do, and you can look at these negotiations, and you can say, from the United States standpoint, from the developed country standpoint, you can see how this is very attractive. You can get more trade liberalization. You get actual reduction and even elimination of tariffs among the countries participating. You can get rules, and very candidly, the United States has been very candid, Europe has been very candid, in a most unfortunate way, in saying we can get new rules of trade, and they're going to be our rules. They're not going to be the rules that the rise of the rest of the world would advocate. And indeed, sometimes, and particularly recently, President Obama said, we're going to have our rules because if we don't do it now, pretty soon China will have the power to impose its rules. I hear what he's saying, and I understand the politics of that. I suggest that that's not particularly constructive in a negotiating context, but it's very much a force in the U.S. and the developed country thinking. Moreover, it's important to think about what those rules are, because the rules that he's talking about are the rules that, as you say, relate to behind-the-border issues. They are rules that do something that the Doha Round never could do, which is to excite the enthusiasm of the international business community. And they reflect a change increasingly in the way trade is done, where trade is no longer, I make something in the United States and I sell it to China or Indonesia. It is, I have design functions in the United States and marketing strategy in the United States, and I have raw materials that I get from Brazil, and I have componentry that I get from Malaysia, and I have major manufacturing and final assembly in China, and we have something called a global value chain. And the way that the business community looks at trade now is that what we need is not so much market access, although they're wrong in one sense, and I'll come back to that. What we need are rules that facilitate the creation and preservation of these global value chains. And they are rules that facilitate our being able to set up portions of our global business in particular countries and have hospitable environments there in terms of things like protection of investment, protection of intellectual property, discipline on competing state-owned enterprises, government procurement rules, rules on worker rights, non-discriminatory environmental rules, harmonization or at least reasonable mutual recognition of standards and regulatory principles. All of those are things that have only marginally been touched on by the World Trade Organization until recently, but are central to the new approach to negotiation. Now, these new negotiations promised something quite substantial for the developed countries. One could argue they promised something substantial for the developing countries, the emerging countries too, because a country that becomes, by its rules that adopts in these negotiations, more hospitable to, more attractive to foreign direct investment, has access relatively greater to foreign direct investment than a country not participating in one of these mega-regional agreements. But the United States has done something that has greatly changed the dynamic of trade, which has great disadvantages for all of the non-participating countries. They are primarily developing and emerging countries, but not entirely. One is that these are rules that are being set in ways that most of the countries represented in this room are having no involvement in developing. And they may be rules that have posed difficulties. State-owned enterprises and investor-state dispute settlement for many of the countries here would pose problems. Worker rights rules pose problems for some countries. Intellectual property rules, to the extent they're being done, pose problems for some countries. And these countries, your countries involved in this roundtable, generally are not involved in setting the rules. They're being set by somebody else. Secondly, you're going to be creating what is, very frankly, a trading block, a trading area that will have advantages for the member countries in relation to the non-participating countries. And they will not just be like free trade agreements in the past, which will have advantages in terms of redirecting trade flows away from non-participating countries to participating countries. They have the potential to redirect investment flows. And that is a very interesting thing and a thing of great concern at a time in world trade where the focus of trade, as you so well said, sir, is now intermixed with development. And if we are developing trade regimes that divert foreign direct investment away from non-participating countries, and the non-participating countries are very largely the developing and emerging countries, you are doing something very significant and of great concern with respect to the relationship between trade and development. But think of it from the United States standpoint more broadly in terms of its relationship, and not just the United States, Europe too, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Canada and Japan and the other countries are participating here, their relationship to and view of the world trading system, the multilateral trading system, and the WTO as the steward of the multilateral trading system. Because as you said, sir, it's important in finding a way to move forward with Doha or with multilateral trade negotiations to have the energy and the resources of the countries involved devoted to this. That's not happening now. I can tell you the energy and resources of the United States and Europe are devoted toward the plurilateral and mega-regional negotiations. Indeed, they are doing so in a way that not just is a diversion of their energy, it is an issue diversion. Because they are dealing here with the issues that they find that they want to deal with, and they don't have to deal with some of the issues that they don't want to deal with. And mode for services is one, agricultural supports is another, peak tariffs is somewhat in this. Special and differential treatment, there is some aspect of this in TPP, for example, but a much different S&DT than there is in what I think are the ambitions of the developing and emerging countries. So what you have is a situation where what the Cordell Hull Institute has thought, and I think most of the people who have been involved in putting together these roundtables have thought, and one of the reasons we have gone into this project is there needs to be a way that we can find to get back to multilateralism. And whether that means doing something to revitalize Doha and get a Doha deal that will be attractive enough to get everybody back involved in it and do something substantial is one possibility. I am pessimistic. whether it is getting Doha done and out of the way, and then focus turning to the WTO as steward of the trading system, as having a responsibility to address the issue for the system that has been raised by the new types of trade negotiations, is another way. And let me suggest a couple things here. The WTO, even assuming you put aside Doha entirely and ask yourself the question, what should the WTO's involvement be with these non-multilateral negotiations? They're not going to stop them. It's too late. You're not, as we say in the United States, you can't put the toothpaste back into the tube. But they have the WTO has traditionally had responsibilities of ensuring that negotiations are transparent. These are not very transparent. The WTO has a traditional responsibility in looking at the extent to which countries, members of the WTO, are doing things that have adverse consequences for other members of the WTO. The WTO has a responsibility, I think, and can assume a responsibility for determining how one might multilateralize things that are multilateralized and perhaps in the process maybe significantly modify things that are being developed in these non-multilateral negotiations. And let me pause there for just a second, because after all I've said, you probably say, well, that's fine, but the United States and Europe aren't going to have any interest in that. I'm not so sure. Short term, certainly the U.S. focus is not on, and Europe's focus is not on going back to the WTO and multilateralizing. I'm afraid that's just a fact. And moreover, they're going to be saying things like, we want it to be our rules, not the rules established by the rest of the world, that are really contrary to that. Sometimes they may even say, we won't join the international bank. Oh, sorry, forget that. No country would be stupid enough to do that. Anyway, so, remember, first of all, what I said about the Clinton administration. Go back to the Clinton administration. Future of trade for the developed countries is, in the long run, ensuring that their economies are sufficiently integrated with and have access to the faster-growing economies. And that is not being achieved by these non-multilateral negotiations. Secondly, the United States, and by the way, China shares, I think, that view, that interest very much. Secondly, the United States historically has been the leader and the champion of multilateralization until fairly recently. The United States has thought of itself as the proponent of and the architect of the multilateral trading system. The United States has a great interest in that. The United States, I think, no matter how strong it feels about the new type of trade negotiations, in the long run can be convinced it must not turn its back on that. And China has the same interest, as shown by all the concessions you were willing to make, more concessions than I would have made as your negotiator, to accede to the WTO in your accession protocol. I don't think China, however, and I'm now going to come to the last part of your talk about recommendations for China. I don't think China can itself bring about changes and bring us back to multilateralism. I also don't think China is in a position at the moment to join the TPP, although you might. The U.S. has a wonderful view of build it and they will come, and the TPP will be so wonderful that everybody will feel that we have to join. It may have worked for Kevin Costner in the movie Field of Dreams. I'm not sure it's going to work for the United States here. But China should look, it seems to me, can look at the world, at the dynamics within the world trading system. And I think you will perceive, and certainly I have perceived in these roundtables that we have around the developing, or the emerging world, that there is a vacuum of leadership and a vacuum of cooperation among the countries that have the interest that we, you and I, have talked about in addressing the concerns raised by these new types of negotiations. We go to, and I apologize to you, Vera, and I apologize to you, Peter, but we went to Brazil, and we went to South Africa, and what I saw there is essentially a paralysis of policy decision making. They have no concept of how they can effectively respond to what's going on. India, and I say this with Anwar Al, I say this with some apologies to you, India, by the actions it's done in the last year or so, has kind of taken itself out of the possibility of leading a cooperative effort to bring cooperation between the emerging and the developed countries. Russia has, for very different reasons, taking itself out of the business of cooperating with anybody. And there's a need for leadership. Somebody needs to step up to the bat to become influential in organizationally effective in and intellectually and politically a leader in bringing the developing world to the WTO, the developing emerging world, particularly the emerging countries, to the WTO in a way that the WTO and the developed countries will find as an effective counterforce. And I think China really needs to think about that. And I think an element of that is to avoid, despite the kind of abrasive language of the United States, to avoid confrontational relationship with the United States on that. To make it clear to the United States and Europe that what you are doing is searching for areas of convergence, areas of common ground. You will not have entire common ground, but that your posture in this is you must understand that the things you're doing are things that in many ways we want to see changes in, but we want to work with you for the benefit of the trading system and for the long-term benefit of all of us. If that sort of thing doesn't happen, if instead we go to confrontation, if instead we go to rival trading blocks, if instead we end up in an Asian Pacific region where you have the RCEP on one hand and the TPP on the other hand as confrontational blocks, and there is no effective voice, coordinated voice from the developing and the emerging worlds in the WTO, I fear for the trading system. And I think China has far be it from me, an American, to say to China, by God, this is what your policy ought to be. But I think these are things you need to think about. And I would urge you to do that. And I would urge you to do that in the view that we are at a tremendously important juncture in world trade for the reasons that you and I have both talked about, and that somebody on the developing and emerging world side needs to be thinking of where is the road, not just immediately in Azevedo's process, but the longer-term road to putting the system back together again. I talk too much, I always do that. I feel very passionately about it.
Thank you for your very impressive comments. And I would like to invite Professor Wang Yong to give your comments.
Thank you, Chairman, for this talk. It's a great honor and pleasure to be invited to this great dialogue. I'm very happy about this chance. I'm very happy to make some responses to Ambassador Sun's great remark, which I think it's informative, insightful, stimulating, and forward-looking. It's a real jet. Just speaking, I share this cautiously optimistic assessment about the future of dollar bonds, about the future of the multilateral trading system. But as a colleague mentioned, we are at a critical moment. To the size of which directions our trading system will take. So I think we have to be work very hard on the finding ability to give analysis of the factors affecting the future. And on this, I'd like to focus on the factors leading to a lot of uncertainties about the early conclusions of the Doha Round and the future of the WTO. Some of the points are just an echo to the judgment of Ambassador Sun. We have the good news. We have help us to make an optimistic judgment. But on the other hand, we also have the bad news, the negative factors, leading us not so optimistic. The first factors, I think, the impact of global financial crisis. Ambassador Sun mentioned that it's very important, leading to the stillness of the negotiation. I think we may need to look at into broader context. Okay, that is talking about the rise of emerging economies in the last 50 years. Okay, that is a broader strategic context in the negotiations has taken place, and the sources of profit we have from. I think specifically on the result of this changing economic landscape, the rise of emerging economies, I would like to see that the impact on the way how we perceived or the calculate the cost and benefit of the negotiations related to the Doha Round, especially who is the loser, who is the winner of these the existing trading rules of the WTO. That is a great input. So I think it's very clear. I think today, at the year of 2015, is very different from the time when the Doha Round was launched. Very different, so 15 years. So I think that is good. Some people in Western countries, especially in the United States. Okay. So we have to rethink it. So about the negotiation model. So that's a very, very important thing. So I think that is first the factors I'd like to give emphasis. The second factor is about the nature of the WTO, which mainly are member-driven regime. That's our problems mainly come from these structures of the power, member-driven regimes. So I think from the precedent negotiations, we see the major role, the major trading partners played a very important role in deciding the structure, the result. As our colleagues have said that. But for this time, we see the emerging economies has entered the core and the core group of negotiations to replace the formal decision making mechanism. We are focused on the big the four parties. So now we see a growing divisions between the groups of the major trading countries, the developed countries versus emerging economies. Now we have no equal bargaining positions. So we can set the negotiations in a very difficult process. So I think that is, we have to look at where we pay more attention to the growing divisions between the two global countries. So that is comes from, based to this, we see the growing number of WTO members So I think that is to make them more complicated and politically difficult to achieve any meaningful concessions. So the big, that is the realities we have to face up to. We have to think about what the solutions that we can get. The third point I would like to mention as about the spin, also emphasized, that is the importance of domestic politics, especially in the major trading partners. So I think it's not very favorable to the early conclusions of the Doha Round. So I think the U.S., I think that is the most important factors. Now look at the role of the business community. We see the, let's say, reducing the wheel of the resources from the U.S. business community to put on the multilateral negotiations. They prefer the solutions of the MAP regional FTAs, such as TPP. So I think that is something they have an extra list on the Doha Round. So I think that is a very, very important factor. So you look at the past, the recent histories of the formal negotiations in the Euro Round. The important role of these communities lobbying the respective governments in Japan, Europe, and the United States. Okay, that is very key issues. That is, and related to this, we are also thinking that is politicization of foreign policy in the United States, especially this year. Practical results more difficult to be achieved. Look at the case of the Iranian nuclear deal. So I think that is all these things related. So we can't expect the Congress, U.S. Congress, and the executive branch to work together just on the trade issues. I think that is our growing part in politics. It will put the mood of the relationship between the two branches in the more difficult footing. So I think I'm not very sort of optimistic about that, even about the TPP. As fourth point, as Dr. Sven also mentioned that, all these the major trading nations have a very full trade agenda, the domestic. So the U.S. will put more focus on the TPP, will invest more resources on that. So they have already has proved that's a very hard battleship. In China, we see the grander plans as ongoing, like one of those China's new Silk Road initiatives. China may spend more energies on the negotiations of RCEP and upgrading of the China, the ASEAN, the FTAs. And what about Europe? The Europe and which is still in recessions, which is still plagued by the debt crisis and plagued by the tension between the relationship with Russia over the Ukraine crisis. All these things. Not a very favorable. So generally speaking, we have some positive factors leading us to cautiously optimistic judgment about the future. But we also have a lot of hard conditions. Finally, I would like to how we can work together to define the solutions, or we ought about the future of the Doha Round, the future of the WTO. And the first the point I'd like to make, as we have taken full advantage of G20 to rebuild the strategic consensus. So I think I'm very happy in recent years in the G20 agenda. There's a growing position, a higher position of trade and investment, especially trade, in the Doha Round. I'm also a member, like Peter, was a member of the G20, of the G20 mechanism, which, in which should be a advisory body to the G20 leaders meeting. We have built some pressures. On the agenda is to put more highlights on the trade issues. We ask the G20 members to work more on the WTO and to ensure that G20 can play some arena to make strategic decisions about WTO, about the Doha Round. So I think we should convey this message more clearly. The second, and we have to, as part of this strategic consensus, as I mentioned, we should have some consensus to insist on the continuation and the early conclusions of the Doha Round implications. We have insisted on the objective of the Doha Round and the development reward. So that is very important. Practically, we have to, in order to achieve the whole package negotiation, so we have to lower our expectations, partially from the major trading partners in the district, lower tension. So we have to, build a consensus on to give more considerations, sympathetic considerations, to the positions, to the interests of the developing countries, partially the least developed countries. So we can construct a big deal, sort of like that, but be focused on the things. That means we have to lower our expectations on the major trading partners. The last point, how do we treat or deal with the issue of plurilateral negotiations to fit or to satisfy the demands or the needs of the different groups of members of the WTO? Now, I know that in some countries, plurilateral is very, negotiations is very controversial. For example, in China, we prefer, as official positions, we prefer the multilateral solutions rather than the plurilateral negotiations. But I mentioned that in order to move forward, we have to be more realistic and practical. So I think that we, as our colleague talked about the grand bargaining. So in my understanding, there should be some treaty between on the some lower standard, the multilateral deal, and the more positive signals to the plurilateral negotiations. So the once the members are ready to the any of them, we should encourage them to pursue in that way. So like in the case of TISA, China also has demonstrated a great interest in joining TISA. But they say China's current positions haven't yet decided at this moment. So how to balance that? So I think that is very important. So we are here and we should give more practical solution. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Wang. Pastor, would you like to
just give a brief.
Well, thank you very much for this the comments. I think we share the same common aspirations. Of course, all of us would like to further strengthen the multilateral trading system, which is very, very important for this world prosperity and world peace. Then, of course, Professor Cunningham mentioned about the U.S. position. I fully understand the positions that at the moment that the U.S. take, because in the WTO is really is a product of the post-war period, and the U.S. has been the leader of this multilateral trading system. Of course, at the same time, it would like to the organization accept all the rules that set in the U.S. To be the international rules. But now, I think the things that how the rules could be set to meet the changing world by participation of all the major countries, emerging economies, and the broad members of the developing and LDC countries. Because we want these rules to be implemented by all members, so it is important to change the mentality eventually to meet the changing world. And for the U.S. in this whole consideration, to turn the Doha round from the development agenda into a horse trading, only for meeting the U.S. need for market access in NAMA, agriculture, and service, really totally changed the flavor. By dropping Doha round and trying to introduce new issues, behind border issues, I think it's a non-starter, because the grand majority of the developing countries would not accept that. We could recall when the EU and US tried to push the start of Doha round, they would like to have the Singapore issues, the new issues. But because of the strong rejection from developing countries, WTO will have to drop three of the four Singapore issues. Fortunately, we got the trade facilitation first, in spite of the strong resistance from developing countries at that time. And that is because the level of economic development are different. For instance, the strong resistance from developing countries against this competition policy. At that time, not so many countries, developing countries, even had the competition law back at home. How could they negotiate competition policy in the Doha round? So it's only natural they would resist. And for the, many of those new issues, I think many of the developing countries were strongly against many of those things like SOEs and IPR and labor environment, because their level of economic development have not yet raised to that level. So we need some time. And also, you have to try to address their urgent concerns, the developing country concerns, their market access, their growth of agricultural products, and their export of textiles, garments, and many of this primitive industries. So without addressing their concerns and putting emphasis on the U.S. concerns of market access, will be very difficult. Of course, there should be a kind of compromise, try to reach some compromise right at the middle, and maybe the best idea is to try to complete the Doha round to meet the 20th century issues, solve 20th century issues first before we start to tackle with this 21st century issues. That's my initial response.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the keynote speakers and for our respondents and for the wonderful speech and the comments.
Now we conclude the first session of this round table. And before we have the tea breaks, I invite all the, we have a group teacher. Okay.
Where?
Just here. So we all stand it, yeah.
Oh, it's deep,
Okay.